This is the podcast recording for Physics 2710 on the 30th of January, 2007. How many of you got a chance to read the wave equation article I sent you? Was it sweet?
It was amazing.
Wasn't it cute?
And I learned a new operator from it.
Good. Did you get that, Deb and Teresa?
I did. I got it. I can't say I studied it in depth. I looked at it.
Okay.
The first two pages were fine. And then when I started trying to imagine the three-dimensional thing, it's like, all right, never mind.
I want to develop your powers of visualization.
So I started looking at the Mechanical Universe videos. And there's a whole one on integrals, and there's a whole one on derivatives. And that really helped me visualize. So
that's good.
What I did.
That's a good way to start. The reason I sent you that wave equation thing was because of a homework problem that some of you have asked about. Number 22 on page 116, because in that wave equation article, we end up with that wave equation that is in problem 22, exactly as you see it. It's in your wave equation article toward the end. So, how do you show that some function satisfies the wave equation? Remember, when you have a differential equation, the solution is not a number, the solution is a function. So we're looking for functions which, along with the appropriate derivatives stuffed into the wave equation, make the left side equal the right side or satisfy that equation. So how do you go about verifying? Well, that's just the procedure I just mentioned to you. You take the appropriate derivatives and stuff everything, whatever it calls for, into the differential equation and see if the left side is equal to the right side. So you weren't asked to come up with a solution. You were merely asked to verify that this given function, psi of x and t, satisfies the equation. So you would need to take, well, what kind of derivatives do we need to take? We need to take two partial derivatives. In fact, we need to take two second-order partial derivatives in order to stuff them back into the wave equation.
It does want you to come up with an equation for the a of t, though.
Yeah,
doesn't
it?
Yeah. Okay. Then I understood.
Well,
right?
Oh, yeah. Okay. We're there. Let's zoom in on this. That's a second-order partial differential equation. I hope that most of you have seen this symbol before. Deb, are you familiar with partial derivatives?
I should be.
You've seen them before at some former life, huh? This means that we're going to take the derivative with respect to t, but while we're doing this part, we're not going to take the derivative with respect to x. We will consider x a constant. And likewise, in this term, we're going to take the derivative of psi with respect to x, but when we do that, we're going to consider t a constant while we do this part. So you start with this, and you start taking derivatives. Take the derivative of this with respect to x, where t is a constant, and what do you get if you do that? Say if t is a constant, then a of t, this is actually a function of time, but if time is not changing, then that's just a constant. So you now need to take, if we're doing it with respect to x, you need to take the derivative of the sine, which is
cosine,
and then the chain rule says this derivative of the stuff inside, so we need to bring out an n pi over L. Mm-hmm. That would be the first derivative of psi with respect to x. We need to do that again. So imagine what we just got and take the derivative of it.
Okay, wait, slow down just a sec. The next to the psi, the x and t, that little notation right there, where you've got the parentheses x comma t.
Yes.
That always means that we first take the derivative with respect to x, and then we take the derivative with respect to t?
No, not at all. This notation merely means that psi is a function of both variables, and it actually, in many cases, doesn't care or matter what the order is. That is, so we don't have to take the derivative in any particular order. All I was doing was starting with the easiest one, which was with respect to x. Actually, I don't know if it's easy or not, but I just picked one to start with. I need to take the second derivative of psi with respect to x to get this term, and then at some point, whether I do it before or after, doesn't matter, I will also need to take the second derivative of psi with respect to t. That's what this says. So I need this, and I need this, and I'm given my original function as a function of both variables. So I want to take the first derivative with respect to x, and then again, do the same thing and take the second derivative with respect to x, and that I'm going to plug in right here. And then, like I say, it doesn't matter whether you do it before or after, but at some point in time, we'll have to go back to this and take the derivative of this with respect to t, and then again, so that we can have the second derivative of psi with respect to t, and that will be plugged in here. And then we're supposed to show that the equation is satisfied. Does that make sense, Deb?
Clear as peanut butter. That makes sense when you explain it like that, but I would not have read that and said, oh, well, of course, this is what I need to do.
Well, that's why we ask questions.
I actually understand class today so far.
Let's see. Oh, I've got the answer book here, but it is not showing the first derivative. So as usual, they're skipping steps like mad.
Even the book.
But they claim that's the second derivative of that psi thing with respect to t. Now, I think I would agree with that. Remember what psi was. I have to flip back and forth between the two books here. If we take the derivative of this with respect to t, you get a prime of t, and then all of this stuff is a constant with respect to t. So then we take the derivative with respect to t again, and we get a double prime, or d squared a dt squared, and this is still just a constant. So that's where they got that part. Okay? Then we do the same thing for x. We need to take the derivative of this with respect to x, and that means the a of t is a constant. So we got the sine, and we got stuff out in front from the chain rule. And then we did it again. This is still a constant. And then we get the minus cosine, and we get the stuff inside out again a second time. And so, with respect to x, the second derivative is minus a is a constant. There's all the stuff that came out of the chain rule twice. And we started with the sine, went to the cosine, then went back to the negative sine. So we get back to the sine. That's the second derivative with respect to x of this function. So that's this term. And you plug everything in, and voila, it's supposed to work. There's the next. So we just went through that step, and we went through that step. Then you plug them into the original equation. So this goes in for that, and that's that right there. And this stuff goes in for the for this, and so that's this term right here. Equals zero is what we had on our wave equation. And that's then supposed to show you what the a of t has to be. The second derivative of a with respect to t has to be all of this stuff. Because, look, if you take this whole term to the other side, then you have a sine n pi x over l on each side, so those would cancel. They skip a lot of steps here. But basically, when you cancel those off, you have multiply both sides by c squared, and you have this thing right here left, and all of this stuff plus the new c squared that we multiplied up on the right, because the signs canceled. I hope that was helpful. Miles was... go ahead.
Can I get an email of that? Can I get a copy of that? Of the solution manual?
I'm thinking. I'm debating. Miles is upset that they used this for the frequency.
I am.
Me too.
In fact, every time I come across it in a book, I write F across it.
Because he's so used to our other book, which uses F for frequency. But Knight goes especially easy on you with regard to the notation. He's especially careful to make sure that everything is notationally correct and pedagogically easy to understand. But most physicists are not nearly that careful and very sloppy. And that's not an argument for using new, but it is common to use new. And so you just have to get used to multiple notations. What?
I noticed it too. I can't remember where I saw it, though. It wasn't in here then?
Is that last chapter, 24?
Did he use new as well?
Stuff like that?
Yes. I think so. I don't remember.
Maybe didn't. Maybe I just think it.
See, we would remember that the angular frequency was written as omega, and we would have said omega equals 2 pi f.
Yeah.
And this book uses the new instead of the f for frequency. So the angular frequency is 2 pi new. But hey, you want to learn the whole Greek alphabet anyway, and this is just the chance
to
do it.
I'm just learning about
eta. About what?
Is that how you pronounce it? E-T-A?
Okay, so Deb, I'm still contemplating sending you that solution. Do you think I ought to?
Well, it would help me to just sleep on it with my head, and I'll just put it in my pillow, and then I'll absorb it all osmosis-like.
I'll make you a deal. I'll send it to you after you read the wave equation article I already sent you.
I have read it.
Okay, all right. All right, let's go back to the camera. Any further questions from chapter 3? There. Well, maybe I should make a couple of comments before we absolutely leave everything.
Can I ask questions later in chapter
3? What's, how do you pronounce it?
E-T-A?
Ada. Ada?
Where did you find it?
It's in chapter 26. I just read it.
Oh.
When we turn into
oh, not in here.
No.
Okay.
I'm sure there's one in here, too.
Yeah, Ada gets used a lot, too. So, any questions about the Compton effect?
Oh, man, I don't even remember the Compton effect.
One of the questions asked us if we should use relativistic versus the classic, and I, in my logic, and tell me if I'm not logicing this correctly, but I'm thinking that 2 × 10⁷ meters per second is 60% of the speed of light. So yes, I'm going to use relativistic speeds. But in the chapter, it says because we're in electron volts, we're dealing with. Let me see if I can find the exact quote. Because we're just dealing with electron volts, we're safe in using the non-relativistic form of the electron's kinetic energy. On page 101, in the middle of the page, right under 3.29. So I'm a little curious about the discrepancy. Or maybe there's not a discrepancy, I just see one.
Quote me the number again you said, 2 × 10⁷?
Yeah, on problem 3, the velocity is 2 × 10⁷ meters per second, and it just asks us, should you use relativistic calculations? And I said yes, because we're at 0.6, the speed of light, I think it's 0.6.
What's the speed of light?
3 × 10⁸.
So if you divide 2 × 10⁷ by 3 × 10⁷, what do you get?
You get 6%.
Not 60.
0.06.
Yeah, I thought you said earlier 60%.
Oh, I'm sorry. No. 6%. Sorry.
6% is not enough to need relativity.
Because we decided it had to be at least 10%. Is that correct?
Rule of thumb.
Oh, okay. All right.
As a side note, can I ask where the electron volts came from? Because I hadn't heard of them until, I think it was on Mastering Physics, so I just looked up the conversion factor.
Oh.
But where did they come from?
Let me make one other comment about her question first, and we'll talk about electron volts. So I guess the rule of thumb is if the object is moving more than 10% of the speed of light, you might want to consider using the relativistic equations. In general, the relativistic equations require a bit more algebra or arithmetic to crunch through. And so you don't want to do it if you don't need to. But the 10% thing is really only a generalized rule of thumb, and it may not be sufficient for your particular application. Even at 10% of the speed of light, the relativistic effects are not great. For some engineering applications, it may not be necessary to use relativity even at 10 or 15 or 20% of the speed of light. But in other really precise applications, cutting-edge research where it has to work exactly right, maybe you'll want to apply relativistic equations even if it's moving slightly less than 10% of the speed of light. So you have to know the context and the application of what you're doing. One way to actually find out is to try it and actually, you know, maybe you don't want to do this every time, but until you get a feel for things, crunch both equations, the classical equation and the relativistic equation, and see how different the answers are. And if they're not very different.
So that's what I did, and I get like 11, 37 volts versus 1141 volts. How different is that?
Well, take a percent difference between those two, meaning subtract them and divide by one of them, 1141, say. So subtract them. What's the difference between the two?
Three.
If I get about four, right? From 37 to 41 is about four?
Oh, yeah, four. I'm sorry.
So four divided by 1141. What do you get when you put that in your calculator?
3.5 times 10 to the negative third.
Okay, to convert that to a percentage, you multiply by 100.
So 0.35%.
So less than 1% difference in the two answers. You know, a third of a percent difference between the classical answer and the relativistic answer. For most applications, that's not different enough to matter.
I just wasn't sure if the voltage, you know, because I don't have a good feel for voltages, is that not, I mean, is that going to affect the number of photons? Like, you know, I just don't have a good feel for what that means in the real world.
Okay, well, then it brings up our time to answer Miles' question about electron volts. But do you see that less than 1% is not very much?
Right, yes.
And you can see how to compute that less than 1% by calculating the two values and taking the percent difference?
Right. There's some other problems later on that talk about that as well.
Okay. So let's talk about the accelerating potential or electron volts. The definition of an electron volt is the amount of energy gained by an electron as it is accelerated across a potential difference of 1 volt, which means that if you took a regular AA battery out of your remote control and bent the terminals around so they could be seen, not have the battery in the way, and release the electron from the negative end and let it accelerate toward the positive end, it would gain energy as it speeds up, as it's accelerated toward the positive end, which is attracting the negative charge. The amount of energy it would gain would be about 1 electron volt. It would be 1.5, because your battery is 1.5 volts. So it would gain an energy of 1.5 EV for a regular 1.5-volt battery. Now, if you have a bunch of electrons, and they all move across that 1 volt difference, then the energy gained by the whole glob of them might be a whole bunch of electron volts. Or if you accelerate them across many volts, not just a 1 volt battery, but if you get some electrodes, put a voltage difference, a potential across them of 1,000 volts or 1,141 volts, then those electrons would gain however much energy it said, in order to reach a speed of 2 times 10 to the 7th meters per second. So the EV is a unit of energy, and it's really tiny. It's a small amount of energy, and you see that by the conversion factor, which is at the very bottom of the inside front cover of your book. 1 electron volt is 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 joules. Even a joule is not a huge unit of energy. You eat, what, 8 million joules a day in your diet? 1 times 10 to the minus 19th of that, of one of those, is a small, tiny amount of energy. But in atomic physics, this is the unit that's convenient rather than always having exponents of minus 19s and 20s and 23s. If you want to have, you know, normal-sized numbers, then you've got to pick your units to be small. And EVs do that for you. And it's also... I didn't do enough of this when I was a student. I probably should have, but there are a few little tidbits of information that might seem like useless trivia to most students, but to a physics student, they become very useful if you tuck them away and remember them. And that is, so I finally learned a couple of these. But the amount of energy in a photon of visible light is on the order of 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 EV. Okay? The energy in a photon, you remember, is given by H times the frequency, HF in our other book, or H nu in this book. The energy in a photon for visible light is on the order of a few electron volts. So that's a nice number to tuck away and remember in your head. It gives you kind of a feel for the size of the unit, or vice versa. If you know what an electron volt is defined to be, it can give you a feel for how much energy light carries. Now, that is to say, if you had 1.6 times 10 to the 19th, one over that, photons, then you'd have a joule's worth of energy in your light. Does that help?
Mm-hmm. That helped a lot.
Anybody else? Follow-up question? Pursue? Okay, there's one last...
On a different subject.
Yeah, go ahead.
Remember that question that I asked you about the mass of massless particles? And you said you needed to give it some thought.
Oh, did I take a homework assignment?
Yes.
Okay, remind me the question again.
Well, how do we know light doesn't have mass? And I know from all the equations, if it does have mass, nothing works. But according to their proof, which is on page... starts on page 65 over to 66. The way that they logic through that, I don't see where they can just say that as the mass goes to zero, it just says the fact that U equals C follows directly from this equation after careful consideration of letting M go to zero. Because when I see that M goes to zero, I just see that both sides equal zero. Am I not thinking about that correctly? On page 66.
Let me find another equation here. One I would like to be.
When accelerated across the potential difference of 1 volt.
Okay, because in the back of my brain, I'm thinking, isn't light affected by very strong gravitational fields?
Yes.
So, is that strictly due to momentum?
I really like your questions, because this is how I would like to run the course, is based on your questions. So, even though your question doesn't apply to this chapter, we'll take it and run with it. And maybe it's a roundabout way to answer your concern about the massless part of it, too. But contrary to what I wrote on the chalkboard in physics 2 hours ago, Miles feels betrayed, but I've admitted all along that other class is a pack of lies from start to finish, and this is where you learn the truth. I wrote up there that the gravitational force is a force between two objects with mass, and that's what you're thinking, that objects have to have mass in order to feel a gravitational force. That's Newton's law of gravitation. That's the way we understood gravitation for these many hundreds of years. But Einstein introduced another way of thinking about gravitation that does not require that the objects have mass. That is to say that Einstein's idea or conception, visualization of gravitation is that it curves or bends or warps the four-dimensional space-time around the mass. That is to say, a heavy mass, a massive mass, massive object, I should say, really warps and bends the space around it. And other objects feel the bent space and travel in paths that might be orbits, might be circular orbits, but probably more commonly elliptical orbits, like Kepler taught us, or it can be hyperbolic or parabolic orbits, like comets are. And it actually reduces down to Newtonian gravity in very good approximation. However, if you have a strong gravitational field produced by a very massive object like a star or a black hole or something, then the two theories don't agree, and we can actually make measurements on this because the two theories do not make the same predictions about Mercury's orbit. Mercury is close enough to the Sun that the gravitational field near the Sun is strong enough that you can detect the difference between the classical prediction and the general relativistic prediction of this bent space idea. By the way, this is not the same as the special relativity that we studied in Chapter 2. This is general relativity that we study in Chapter 15. But you asked. And we can detect the different, well, the predictions are different, and we can make measurements on Mercury's orbit that are easily accurate enough to determine which of the two theories is right. And it is not Newton. General relativity is the correct theory of gravitation. In cases of low gravity, they reduce to the same numbers. But in cases of strong gravity, they don't. And Einstein is right, and Newton is wrong. What this bent space idea then allows us to conceive of with regard to massless particles and light is that they too, even though they don't have mass, feel this curvature of space and they take the path of least resistance. Or in the dynamic of the bent space-time, all they're trying to do is be good little citizens of the universe and follow the path of least resistance, the shortest distance between two points in the bent space-time, which is not a straight line. So even light is bent around stars or black holes, even though it's massless, because we're not thinking of the Newtonian theory of gravity anymore that requires both objects to have mass. We're thinking of the general relativistic Einsteinian theory, which talks about the bent space, and even light has to follow the bent space. More than you wanted to know, right?
No, that actually makes a lot more sense than what I was trying to think about it, how I was trying to think about it. Because I've heard about the bent space, but I didn't know how the light traveled along the bent space.
There's a theorem that we use in classical optics. These students just encountered it a week ago, called Fermat's principle of least action or least time, which says that light will get from point A to point B in the least amount of time, even though it may not be the shortest path in space. And if you stick a lens in there, the path of least time is the refracted path that it follows. And you can prove this mathematically. Or for a mirror, it obeys the law of reflection because that's the path of least time. You can kind of generalize that then to the bent space and say that the shortest distance between two points in bent space isn't a straight line, and it would be a curved path around the massive object in the center. In fact, if your gravity is strong enough, so the curvature is curved enough, you can even make light orbit a star or a planet or a black hole.
That's amazing. That is amazing.
Yeah, but we'll get back to that again in Chapter 15.
Okay, so I can believe that photons don't really have mass.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so. Now, that's not to say that they don't carry energy and momentum. We've associated those concepts before in the past in classical physics, too. It has to have mass in order to carry momentum, because momentum is mv. But that's not true either in the relativistic equations, and light particles, which are massless, do carry energy and momentum. Okay, section 9 of chapter 3 is the last little piece there we need to finish up. It starts on page 110, and it is simply the idea that, believing Einstein's E equals mc squared equation, that if that's true, we can convert mass to energy and energy to mass back and forth. And so if you can collect up enough energy in one place at one time, you can make particles. You can create matter. Now, 100 years before that, classically, they would have had a law of conservation of mass. And they would have had another law of conservation of energy. And they would have said neither one of them could ever be created nor destroyed. They can be transformed maybe from one form to another, especially energy. We know about lots of different kinds or forms of energy. But you can't destroy it. It's got to be there somehow, somewhere. And they would have said the same thing about matter. But now Einstein's tied them together and kind of combine them into one conservation law of energy mass. You can actually convert from one to the other by means of this E equals MC squared equation, which is really amazing when you crunch the numbers. I think we did this back in chapter 2, didn't we? If you had 1 kilogram of mass and you're able to totally convert it to energy, how much would you have? Do you remember this little calculation we did? It's E equals MC squared. So if M is 1, all we need to do is figure out what C squared is. And I think Miles told us what C squared was.
Remember, 9 times by 10 to the, what is it, 8 squared would be 16?
9 times 10 to the 16. From 1 kilogram of mass, if you convert it all, you'd get 9 times 10 to the 16 joules of energy. Now you're starting to talk real energy. I mean, that's a lot. That's enough to power the Starship Enterprise. That's how they do it with their antimatter pods or whatever they call them.
Yes, now I know.
And traveling at more than the speed of light.
Speaking of which, however, Teresa, they don't violate the laws of physics. They get around them. When Captain Picard says, make it so, and they're going at warp 20, whatever it is, they are not going through space at faster than the speed of light because that would violate the theory of relativity. But the reason they call it warp 3 or warp 7, or if Scotty really has to stoke up the antimatter engines, warp 9, they aren't really traveling through space. They're, again, bending space. If you need to get from point A to point B in less time than it would take light to get there, you can't travel through space to do that, so you bend the space and bring point A to point B close by and hop over, and you've warped the space, and that's what warp 1 is.
Don't you like how they can talk through space on their subspace and they're chatting in real time across the universe? I like that part.
Yes. If you happen to be a Star Trek aficionado, may I recommend a delightful little book by a physicist by the name of Lawrence Krauss called The Physics of Star Trek. And he talks about all of this stuff, including the subspace and the warp, and also the teleporters, and all kinds of other stuff there, all the interesting things they do in Star Trek. It's a great read. It's one, you know, page-turner. Can't put it down. They tried hard to not out-and-out violate the laws of physics. They got around them in sneaky ways. Do we know how to warp space like that and hop over? No, we have no clue. But in theory, you know, it doesn't violate the laws of physics as we understand them. It's just an engineering problem to figure out how to actually bend the space like that. And so there's some interesting issues there. There's a follow-up book by a different guy called The Metaphysics of Star Trek, which examines the philosophical issues posed by the technology, such as when you teleport to somewhere else, is it really you, or is it a copy of you? Well, they have replicators that work the same way the teleporters do, except the teleporters destroy the original.
That's scary.
And so if you get caught in the middle before you materialize at the far sight and your original one's disappeared, you know, destroyed, then where are you? And do they actually send the particles to the other teleporter beam, or just the information about which particles to assemble?
Depends
over
what
there
kind of function it is, if they pass by reference or if they
So could you like save this information, if it is information, and then theoretically live forever just by keep generating new you?
Well, we claimed the other day in the other class that all electrons are truly identical and all protons are truly identical as to each other. And so it really doesn't matter which protons you're made of, as long as you get the right, you know, the right number of protons and the right number of electrons in the right structure. It's how they're placed in relation to each other that makes the atoms and then the molecules and then the proteins and the cells and then the tissues and the organs and Jacob. It's, you know, you probably have about the same number of protons as Marty Lynn does, but you've got them placed in different ways. And so it's just a knowledge of the information about where to stack these up. So if we could just get that information, we go over here and get a whole new pile of protons out of water or sand or something and just stack them up so that they have exactly the same arrangement as his protons and electrons, he'd be having the same thoughts, same dreams, same goals, same wishes.
Would he have the same memories?
Same memories. That may be beyond the scope of this course, Therese is saying to herself. Nothing's off limits. We can talk about anything we want. Okay. So you can create pairs of things. Notice equation 343 on page 110, that from a photon, which is given the symbol gamma, you can actually create an electron and its antiparticle, because you have to conserve charge. So you can't just make an electron. That wouldn't conserve charge. The gamma doesn't have any charge, the photon, but the electron would. So you can't do that. You have to create them in pairs of oppositely charged particles so that the total sum of the charges after is the same as the charge was before. So you have to make pairs of things that are oppositely charged. And that's where we get the antimatter stuff from. On the other hand, you combine them back again, and what do you get? You get the original photon, or that much energy back out in a photon. Maybe it's a different photon, but you get an equal energy photon. If you combine your electron and your positron back together again, they disappear and annihilate each other, and poof, and they're gone, and in its place is this photon of energy that has the same amount of energy as the E equals MC squared mass of the two particles. That is how the Starship Enterprise is powered. You keep a bottle of matter and a bottle of antimatter, and you combine them, and you get the energy out from their mutual annihilation, according to E equals MC squared. Now, it does say you cannot do this in free space. Figure 320 on the next page. A photon cannot decay into an electron-positron pair in free space, but you have to have momentum conserved as well, and so you need a nucleus nearby so it can absorb some of the momentum to allow the process to proceed. So you do create the pair, but that nucleus needs to kind of be there, sort of like a chemistry catalyst thing. But again, so that all the things that need to be conserved can be conserved, namely in this case, momentum, as well as charge and energy. They all have to be conserved. Who had a comment?
Deb, maybe I misunderstood, but when I was reading the chapter, did it make it clear, or am I way off, but is that electron still the same mass as the electrons that we've been talking about before? And is the positron the exact same mass as the electron? Okay, so that's a good deal. All right.
We're going to go on this claim that all electrons are identical, and you can't tell the difference between any two electrons. So they may have been created in the early days of the universe in the Big Bang, you know, seconds after the Big Bang. Or we might create them in this pair production process. But either way, we wouldn't be able to tell the difference. An electron's an electron is an electron. And a positron, in order to conserve mass and energy and charge, it has to be exactly the same, only opposite in charge.
So, I have a question from the book. It looks like, I mean, they see this happen.
Yes.
You can see, you can observe this happen. But how about protons? Can you do that with protons? You'd have to have an awful lot of energy in your photon, I guess.
You're exactly correct, but yes, we know how to make antiprotons. They don't have
proton, antiproton thing, that can happen too.
Absolutely. If you do a Google search on antiprotons, you'll get a lot of hits. That's actually one of the ways, I'll take the chance here to drive home a point I made earlier. When we talked about the structure of the atom and finding out that there was a nucleus in the center and then electrons, fuzzballs around the outside, we said we used a very tried and true technique that we've used over and over in the history of physics to find that out. And we've since used it at one level deeper to find out that it looks like there are three little hard things inside of protons and neutrons. That's a level of structure smaller. But in both cases, the approach is called smash it and see what comes out, or it's called scattering. But you throw things at the target with a lot of energy and kind of just hope for the big explosion and see what pops out and generate new particles and things like that. So we can make things go fast enough that they have enough energy that you can make pairs of particles. And we do this in our big atom smashers. There's one in Illinois near Chicago called Fermilab. And then probably the number one in the world is in Switzerland. border of Switzerland and Austria called CERN, which is some acronym in French for the European Center for High Nuclear Energy something. Anyway, they take particles and they whip them around by means of electric and magnetic fields and make them go faster and faster and faster and faster and faster, and then they smack them into stuff. And I think we may have used the analogy that's like taking a big sledgehammer and smashing a fine pocket watch and seeing what comes out and using that to determine how the pocket watch was made and how it was constructed. It's very crude, but it's the only game in town. Nobody's ever thought of any other way to determine what's inside of subatomic particles. So it sounds crazy, but it's the only way we know how to do it. So we smack stuff really hard and see what debris flies out. Well, if you want to get bigger and bigger explosions, you have to make your protons go around this ring faster and faster and faster. But at some point, you reach the limit of how strong your electric fields can be to accelerate them and how strong your magnetic fields can be to bend them around in the circle. So you can't get them going any faster than your machine allows, and there's a maximum speed. Then they got clever, and they said, hey, why don't we send protons around this way and antiprotons around the other way at the same time, and then when they smack together, it'll be twice the energy. So they do that now. So they have to create the antiprotons first and send them around the other way, and they get bigger explosions and more debris and more fundamental particles.
Yeah, I think I just heard on the news that they've got a new accelerator collider coming online, and it's supposed to be 27 kilometers in diameter.
Yep.
That would amazing.
That would enclose a small city, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know if you're aware they're doing it. It's not an accelerator, but out here they have something they're putting it in right now called, in the West Desert, it's the Cosmic Ray Telescopic Array that the University of Utah and the University in Japan, they're placing out all these detectors. And when I listened to the physicist guy who's in charge of the talk, they're looking for these particles coming into the atmosphere that are huge, huge, high energies, and watching what they do as they hit our atmosphere and smash all up into pieces or something.
Yeah.
So that's going in over here in this part
of
the state.
Actually had it there for a while.
That's correct. Is that the fly's eye?
I haven't heard it called that. I just see the big building that they've got
that
standing there. It says the Cosmic Ray Telescopic Project.
Yeah, they're putting all kinds of detectors out, and they're trying to see what comes down from those. Yeah, and those cosmic rays coming in from outer space are going almost the speed of light, as we talked about with the muons before. So they can make pretty big collisions when they hit stuff in our atmosphere, too, and lots of debris from that. So that's analogous. Now, you could even take, if you're really clever, an antiproton and an antielectron, also called a positron, and put them in orbit around each other. And you'd have anti-hydrogen. And it's been recently that they've been able to do that, because these things are fairly short-lived, because there's so many electrons lying around that it's tough to keep your anti-electron from encountering an electron and annihilating. Same with the antiproton. It's not very long before it finds a regular proton and annihilates. So it's tough to collect up large bottles of this stuff. But they have been able to make anti-hydrogen pretty recently. And in theory, you could have anti-everything you want. Is that it for chapter 3? Okay, hearing no objections, then let's talk about the structure of the atom with these different models. The Rutherford scattering is something we've alluded to earlier, but now it comes back in full force. And the scattering idea is one that I'll emphasize again and again as this technique where you send in a target. Well, I guess it's not quite the same as just smacking it and see what debris comes out. But if you send in projectiles and see how they come off, apart from whatever debris might be created, but see how the initial projectiles kind of reflect off or scatter off, then you can kind of deduce back again what the structure was. And that's probably more related directly to finding out that the nucleus was small and dense and massive. And then again, a generation later with the quarks in the proton.
Yeah, because at this point, they don't have detectors. They wouldn't have detectors for antiprotons or antielectrons or anything like that. All they would be able to detect would be whatever they're sending in, right?
I think they can tell when they have antiprotons.
But would Rutherford would he have known what he was looking at? Would his detectors have been able to...
For antiprotons, no. We hadn't conceived of them at that point.
So back to your analogy of smashing it with the watch, smashing the watch with a big hammer. Unless you devise a detector, you won't be able to recognize any of the things that are coming off. So you have to kind of know what to expect.
That is true. I agree with that. If you're going to look for debris of stuff that's created in the explosion that wasn't there before, you have to have a detector that knows how to look for those kinds of things. And so the development and design and construction of detectors is a pretty big subfield in particle physics. There are people who specialize in making such detectors. They're interesting, too. What was the model of the atom before Rutherford found out about the nucleus?
It was the raisins and plum pudding.
The plum pudding, yeah. And who was to say otherwise? We knew it had to be electrically neutral. So you had this goo, mass of positively charged stuff, and then we also knew about electrons. They had just been discovered in 1897. Then just spread them out in the glob, in the glue, like raisins in the pudding. Does fine until you start doing the Rutherford scattering experiment. And what does that lead you to believe?
There's something hard in there.
It does.
The hard things that they were hitting, was that the electrons that they were...
Nucleus.
Or was it the nucleus?
It was the nucleus.
Because there isn't really a hard electron, right?
Right.
Okay.
Because it's a fuzzball?
Right.
Yeah.
It's a wave of...
A wave.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
This is a little bit before quantum mechanics told us they were waves, though. So
right.
We still thought of them
as
particles.
When I was reading it, I was thinking that they were... going like that off of the electron, and that didn't make sense to me, but I was looking closer and the pictures, they have scattering nucleus, so the scatterer is not the electron.
Yes, on page 123 they say scatterer twice in the diagrams, but on page 127 they become more specific and say scattering nucleus. So how am I going to ask this question? What is it about the nucleus that's going to make a particle want to bounce back? It's charge. It's charge. So what are we flinging at these things?
Electrons.
Electrons would be attracted to the...
Alpha particles.
Or no, not electrons. I mean, yeah, the alpha particles.
Alpha particles. And what did we decide alpha particles were?
I forgot.
There's some sort of helium ion, weren't they?
Yes. Doubly charged. It's basically the nucleus of a helium atom, so it has two protons and two neutrons. And it's a very stable arrangement. We'd like to have a couple of electrons to make a nice neutral helium atom, but if it can't find electrons, it's pretty happy just being a doubly charged nucleus flying around bare. There are other atoms that radioactively emit these spontaneously. They're unstable nuclei that Marie Curie found that would just emit these just randomly all the time. Can depend on how strong the source was, but you can get alpha emitters that will give off lots of alpha particles. So Rutherford takes some of those and beams them at his target foils, which are very thin. They're only a few atoms thin, and that's one thing about metals, is they're malleable and ductile. Malleable means you can pound it out very, very thin. Ductile means you can draw it out into a wire. Well, gold is especially ductile and especially malleable, and so you can get it very, very thin, and I mean just a few atoms thick is pretty thin. So, because there are only a few layers of atoms, you would expect most of these particles to go sailing on through. If you have goo with negative charges interspersed throughout, kind of a big blob of goo, you're just going to send them on through. Instead, most of them do go on through, but occasionally a few will have a very sharp angle, of sharp scattering angle that'll send them almost back in the direction they came. It'll scatter them more than 90 degrees, even almost 180 degrees, almost back to the direction that they came from. And that's what is not consistent with the plum pudding model. Yeah, let's look at the computer. There's the Thompson plum pudding model. How do they radiate light? Well, the electrons can vibrate around and emit light when they vibrate around, but other than that, they're kind of stuck where they are. Rutherford is going to investigate this by blasting the alpha particles at the foils. Where's that? Here's multiple scattering. This is a calculation to show that even with a thin layer, you might hit a couple of nuclei pretty closely. So you have to do calculations that account for not just one close collision, but maybe a couple or three or four. So there's the calculation that shows that you can do that based on the thickness of the gold layer and all that stuff. But the experiments that they did were not consistent with the model. So we get this solar system idea down here, which most second grade kids still have to this day. In fact, we use the radiation caution symbol. Looks somewhat like this with a nucleus and, you know, yellow and black. And then the electrons going around in nice orbits. They're not all in the same plane. So in that sense, it's not quite the same as a solar system because the planets are pretty much in the same plane. These are angled at different planes, but still they're orbiting around this solid nucleus. This was the picture that Rutherford gave us, and it's a whole lot better than Thompson's plum pudding model. Not to say that Thompson was dumb, but this is to illustrate the progressive nature of science, and as you do new experiments and find new data and make your model fit everything that you know, you have to revise your mental conception of what things look like. So the planetary model is a great model, but if you were to stop there, it's like ending your education in second grade. You shouldn't keep thinking about atoms like this picture anymore, especially after this class. It's a great model for second grade. It's a great model for 1911, but we've moved on since then. This is some of the math that shows, you've got this diagram in your book, so I don't know if we need to go over it a lot, but it shows you how to get the scattering angle from the impact parameter. This letter B right here is called the impact parameter, and it's the distance in a straight line sort of way from the scattering nucleus, what that would be. Obviously, as B gets smaller, then this will approach the nucleus even closer, and it will tend to bounce even back at a larger and larger angle as B gets smaller. So it depends on B, scattering angle does. You can see that in this equation right here. Also, of course, depends on the electric, the Coulomb repulsive force between them. So this is the number of protons in the projectiles, and this is the number of protons in the scatterer, the target nucleus, and those have to be multiplied together, so it's strongly dependent on that, because it's the repulsive Coulomb force that's doing this, and they show that.
You know, what struck me the most about reading this chapter is that they make all these observations, and then they say, okay, how can we think about this mathematically? And they convert everything into a mathematical precision of explanation. And I guess that's where I am just the weakest, is I don't think mathematically. I don't look at those equations and say, well, of course, that shows, you know, this angle of deflection. And, you know, and that's, I guess that's where I'm the weakest at, is that it's thinking about all of this mathematically in mathematical terms. But that's how all of this, it wasn't anybody sitting around theorizing how this is all going to be and creating a mathematical expression first. Well, okay, except for Einstein. But all of this stuff comes from empirical evidence, and then they try to fit it to, they try to make sense of it mathematically.
I like that comment a lot. Can we switch back to the camera, computer? I mean, the regular camera. And we'll take a minute and talk about this, because I think it's an important point. I guess it's okay that you say your personality is not that inclined. But you do have the math background that you can follow along. I guess I can sympathize when you say that you maybe wouldn't have been able to dream up the math yourself, and I suppose that's okay. But there's an interesting thing about math. I'm reading a book called, right now it's called The Road to Reality, The Complete Guide to the Universe, or something like that. It's by an English physicist by the name of Roger Penrose, who I enjoyed his previous book called The Emperor's New Mind, and he's done some really great physics, so I thought I'd enjoy this book, and I am. It's like this thick, but it's great. It's a math book, though. It's supposed to be a physics book, but it's mostly about the idea of, isn't it absolutely amazing that math describes the universe? Now, that seems like such a cavalier statement. And you say, well, duh, all my physics classes have had math in them. Duh. But no, really get back to the philosophical fundamentals here. Why do we live in a universe that can be described by math? Or another way to say that is, how could we dream up math that describes the universe? Why do they have to have anything to do with each other? I think it's absolutely astounding. And yet it seems to be really, really true that the most cool and interesting things that mathematicians have discovered over the years are applicable to the universe as we understand it. And right now I'm in the section, chapter 8 of this book, and he's talking about complex analysis and the complex plane and the log of complex numbers is a many-valued function. So you have your surface is not a flat surface, it's a coiled helix kind of thing. This ties into modern physics and string theory and stuff like that. So at some level, I hope we're all just absolutely astounded that math does describe the world. I think you could conceive of a universe where that weren't true. Or maybe the astounding thing is not so much that math describes the world, but that our brains can figure out the math that describes the world. I don't know. But I think you ought to be astounded. The next step, though, the next point is that once you have that faith that the universe can be described with mathematical equations, oftentimes they're differential equations, then it maybe isn't quite such a leap. You know, once you believe that you can do that, maybe it's not so bad for somebody to do that. I think maybe the leap is believing that it can be done. Because if you're really well-versed in your math, then it does follow from logical principles. I think if you go through this section in the book very carefully, starting on page 122, but all the way through the following ones, all the math, it kind of had to be that way. It's not ad hoc. It's not someone saying, well, gee, let's just tack on some math or go dream up an equation and see if it fits. I mean, it's proceeding, as you say, Deb, from the empirical evidence, but you say, how can that empirical evidence be described? What has to happen? Well, there's an angle of scattering. What else do I know physically about my experiment? Well, there's an impact parameter. That's the B we were just talking about. If I shoot something in, it's going to be a distance away from a nucleus. And so by reasoning through and also knowing what the results are, you can come up with the equations that make this happen. Some of them are more subtle than others. But I don't think it's too surprising that smart people can come up with these equations. Now, to sympathize with you, Deb, I will tell you that in graduate school, I was heavily involved in a scattering experiment that wasn't to determine the structure of the atom or the structure of the proton. It was one level of size larger. We were shooting electrons at complex organic molecules, hemoglobin-like molecules, fairly hefty molecules. And the math seemed to me kind of like what you just described. Gee, I'm not sure I would have been able to dream this up. I'm not sure I'm smart enough to do that. But somebody was. What we did was we'd shoot beams of electrons, and then we'd have beams of these molecules. We can't just hold one of them. It's tough to hold a molecule in place. So they'd be falling down in a gravitational field, the Earth's. We'd shoot a beam of electrons at them, and the electrons would interact and scatter. It's this word again. The electrons would scatter off of these molecules, and then we'd have a detector on the other side of the tank that would detect the electrons. Well, the tank had to be evacuated because you can't have any air in there, as the electrons would hit the air long before they got to the beam of molecules. So you suck all the air out of there and make a really good vacuum. Then you also know that magnetic fields deflect electrons, so you have to get rid of all the magnetic fields so your beam of electrons will go straight. And that's a whole discussion in itself. Then you've also got to figure out how to make your molecular beam of hemoglobin molecules. How are you going to get a beam of hemoglobin molecules? We did it. And so you've got this beam, this pile of molecules that's falling down. Think about a beam of molecules. Are they going to be like a laser where everything's lockstep, happy, and in together and in phase and monochromatic? No, each molecule is going to be randomly oriented, falling at maybe slightly different rates. And when you hit them with this electron, you have no clue which one you hit is going to be oriented at which angle. And then the next electron is going to hit another hemoglobin molecule oriented at a different angle. The next electron's going to hit a different one at a different angle. And all of those electrons are being scattered from these different molecules onto our detectors. What do we get data-wise? We get the results on our detectors. A lot of electrons went at that angle, a few went at that angle, a few went at that angle, more went at that angle, not very many at that angle. Many went straight through because they didn't hit any of them. And then, you know, assuming it would be symmetric on both sides, but then you have to take that data and deconvolute it, is the mathematical term, to figure out the structure, the shape of the molecule. To me, that sounds like an interesting piece of math, especially considering the fact that each electron is going to hit a different randomly oriented hemoglobin molecule. But if you take data runs of a couple of weeks and get gobs and gobs of this, you get a nice pattern of intensity that's a function of angle, and you run it through the math, the computer programs that do the math, and it tells you exactly where the carbon atoms are and where the iron atom is in your hemoglobin, and it's kind of in a cage of carbons, and how far it is out of the plane. So we can determine how hemoglobin attaches onto oxygen and carries it down through your blood. It's pretty amazing math. So I'm sympathizing with you because I'm saying even I was in awe that someone could deconvolute the data and then arrive at the structure of the molecules from that. I thought that was pretty amazing. But there are lots of people smarter than me. You people are probably among them, so it doesn't bother me.
Can we get A's?
Now, I didn't say you knew more than I did. I just said you were smarter than I am. Let's not carry this too far, Miles.
Well, the thing of it is, I mean, like, you worked with all those equations, so don't people have to spend lots and lots of hours? They have to think about it a long, long time, even very bright people? Or am I just feeling particularly dumb?
Well, I would like to side with you because it would make me feel dumb, too, to think that these people were able to whip them out in just 3 minutes. I think it takes probably more time than most of us would guess to, you know, for the tricky stuff. On the other hand, if you know the fundamentals of physics and geometry, I don't think the derivation of equation 4.6 is, I don't think it would have taken Rutherford 6 months to do. I think he was probably smart enough he could apply the principles and see what the math had to be in a relatively short period of time. But there are different levels, too.
I taught my first lesson in my clinical today, and it's a physics class, but it's a conceptual physics class, so they don't. It's not really math-based. But we did something similar to this because I've been thinking a lot about this. How do people come up with this stuff? And, you know, I presented the way I presented it today. We looked at the relationship between the speed of sound, the frequency of the sound. So we were playing with tubes and things like that, getting the frequencies. And we looked at the wavelength, so the length of the tube. You know, and by the time we were done, we had the relationship. We knew that as the frequency got higher, the wavelength got smaller. And so we actually, you know, so I guess I can, on my little elementary level, I can see what, you know, the thought processes that go through this. But,
yeah,
man, when you start talking.
I agree with you.
start talking relativity and you have to, you know, factor in that it just seems like there's so many variables and there's so many dependent variables that you have to factor in that it's just mind-boggling.
Well, I think one lesson to take home would be if we were to go down to the library stacks and check out some of the physics journals and look at the articles that are published in there, that you're seeing a very many times refined piece of work that's gone through draft after draft, been sent out to reviewers for critique and comment, sent back and revised how many more times, we don't know. And you don't ever get to see the process. All you see is the final work. I'm doing the same thing right now. I'm writing a solutions manual for a physics book. In fact, the second edition of this book right here. And I think they look pretty good when I'm done. But the students aren't going to get to see all the false starts I made when I did it on scratch paper, or the stupid things I did, or when I missed a factor of two or a minus sign. I check my work very carefully, and I find mistakes, and I go back and fix them. And so what I put in the solutions manual is going to be right, I hope. I mean, I hope that I don't let too many slip through. But you don't see all of the time I sit and stare at my ceiling and say, now, how does that work? And after I struggle with it for 2 or 3 minutes, then, oh, okay. Or I try something, and it doesn't work, and I try something else. And you know, all students do that too. I think sometimes it would be nice for us to be more exposed to the process so that we know that most of us are mortals. Now, there are a few probably math immortals that stand above the rest of us head and shoulders that really have a clearer vision both of the physics and of the math. There are people like Richard Feynman, who's probably in that category, just so incredibly brilliant that he wouldn't be in our class. And Newton was so bright that he's, you know, I just read a biography of Newton a while back, and there's an interesting quote in there by one of the other leading lights of the day. I don't remember his name, who it was, but it was a bright person. And his comment was, you know, when I compare myself to other people, other scientists, other intelligent men, I can always come up with a ratio or a factor how much smarter they are than I am. Like, you know, Joe Blow is 3 times smarter than I am, or Fred, he's 6 times smarter than I am, or Bill, he's 23 times smarter than I am. But Newton, it can't be calculated. That was the comment. It's infinitely many times smarter. Now, maybe there are some of those, but I think most of us struggle and have false starts and make mistakes, and we never get to see that. So let's go back to the computer for a few minutes. We've only got about 5 left, but we've got a few more slides here I want to talk to you about on the models of the atom. The planetary model is doomed because, I think somebody brought this up in our other class, why doesn't maybe it was on one of the reading slips.
I wrote it on the slip.
Why doesn't the electron spiral down into the nucleus and you don't have atoms? How can they stay out there in these orbits? Remember, the previous version was the, where'd it go? This picture at the bottom with a nucleus and these orbits. But if the nucleus is positive and the electrons are negative, then shouldn't they attract each other and shouldn't the orbit decay and the electron end up in the nucleus? And the answer is yes, classically that should be the case. Classically that should be the case. Classically atoms can't exist, but atoms do exist, so the world is not classical. So in 1900, with the black body radiation, Planck invented this idea of the quantum of energy, and then it got applied to the Bohr model of the atom. Let's look at these general assumptions, number one addresses this question that we're on now. Why can atoms even exist? Because Bohr said, and this is a totally non-classical statement, he said there are some stationary states where as long as the electron is in one of those states, it does not radiate energy. I mean, that's part of the issue back here, and better make sure we understand this. Classical E&M theory says that if a charged particle is accelerating, it must radiate. Let me say that again. classical E&M theory says that if a charged particle accelerates, it must radiate. Well, if an electron is in a classical circular orbit around the nucleus, that is a form of acceleration. Uniform circular motion is acceleration. And so the electron ought to be radiating, meaning that its energy is going to decrease and its orbit will decay.
Where do we know that? If it's accelerating, it has to be radiating? Like,
from Maxwell's equations, okay, which we'll get to in our other class.
I just didn't understand. It's like, where'd that come from? Why?
Yeah, that's the other class. Bohr said, okay, well, since we do have atoms, let's assume that you can have these stationary states where the electrons don't radiate. Now, this sounds very ad hoc. This sounds like you're really just patching up the theory. It sounds really weak. But, hey, it works. And what other choice do you have? If atoms exist and classical theory says they can't, well, you've got to resolve it somehow. And Bohr's stab at it was as good as any. Bohr did a great job, by the way. Bohr's model is really wonderful. We're not going to stop there either. We liked the plum pudding model. Wasn't quite right. Then Rutherford found the nucleus, so we had the planetary model. We liked it, too, as a stepping stone. But we knew it wasn't quite right either. Bohr model replaced the planetary model of Rutherford, and it was much better, and we like it a lot. But we know that it, too, is not the complete story. It is another stepping stone, and we will not stop with the Bohr model either. However, it's worth it to understand what it's saying. Item 2 here says that if an electron changes from one stationary state to another, jumps in one of these quantum jumps, then it either emits or radiates energy at a specific frequency, HF or H nu. Where?
That's where it's at.
Oh, yeah. Why does the PowerPoint have F, anyway?
Because it's the way it should
Smart.
Be.
So the difference in the energies is emitted as a photon of a particular frequency and multiplied by Planck's constant. And the classical laws of, let's see, conservation of momentum and stuff like that do not apply to transitions between stationary states. They can jump from one to the other, and you don't have to worry about how long did it take or did it conserve momentum. It can just do that. It can absorb energy from a photon that's coming in, and it immediately jumps up to another energy level if the energies correspond. If the difference in the energies of the stationary states is exactly met by the incoming photon, it can just do it. Just jump up and be in the next state or the other state. So those are his assumptions. We want to probably take some time next time to see how it explains lots of things, including the Balmer series of lines. In fact, all of the Rydberg lines, the Paschen series and the infrared, all those series are explained easily by this Bohr model. So Bohr's model of the atom is extremely successful for the hydrogen atom. It is not as successful for other atoms, and we'll get to that next time. I'll warn you ahead of time, I'm working on another quiz, so study up chapter 3 and 4. Then we're going to have a test, too. Great, see you tomorrow.